May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Beverly Bove, and I represent the appellants in this case, Tasha Wilson and Jermaine Emery, the parents of the boy who died in this drowning. With the court's permission, I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is the parents' appeal of the grant of summary judgment from the court below, the Superior Court, barring the case from being tried against the Brown in Superior Court. The procedural posture leading to the court's granting of summary judgment briefly is as follows. This incident occurred on June the 15th, 2008. Our original complaint was filed against the Urquharts, the homeowners, on August the 14th, 2008, 2 months post-incident and post-death. We amended the complaint to add Tapachar Bass, who was the babysitter who brought Damon to this child's pool party on November of 2008. The homeowners, the Urquharts, third-partied in the Browns, the appellees here today, as hosts of the party in September of 2008. We attempted to schedule depositions for 5 months from November of 2008, at one point attempting to file a motion for to compel, which was denied by the court. 1 month later, the court issued a scheduling order on December the 16th, 2008, with a two-week deadline for adding or amending prior to any depositions having been taken in the case. The deadline that the court said controlled the deposition taking was March the 5th. We attempted to, by stipulation, to add the Browns as defendants. The court rejected that stipulation. We filed a motion to amend, and the court granted that motion. We filed the second amended complaint in April of 2009. After that, 18 depositions were taken in a seven-month period of time between July of 2009 and February of 2010. The motion for summary judgment was then filed by the Browns in March of 2010, 3 months prior to the expiring of the statute of limitations. Summary judgment was granted by the lower court on July the 6th of 2010. We then appealed. The homeowners, the Urquharts, settled this case prior to the argument on the motion for summary judgment, and Tapachar Bass, the babysitter, settled the case after the argument on the motion for summary judgment. On the attractive nuisance issue, the defendants had pled in their moving papers for summary judgment that the attractive nuisance issue, in essence, was a new theory, a new issue, although they refer to in the complaint, in their moving papers, that it was referred in the complaint and included by reference. They argued it was a new theory. In the argument on the motion for summary judgment, the court seemed to consider that it might be considering that a new theory, and given the court's reluctance to grant prior amendments and the court's granting of the Browns a supplemental argument on that new theory before the deciding of the motion for summary judgment.
Ms. Bell, I think we're, at least I am getting lost in the convolutions, the procedural convolutions of this case. I gather that the appeal is from a grant of summary judgment adverse to your client and in favor of the defendants.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And so necessarily your position is that the court erred as a matter of law in granting summary judgment.
Correct, Your Honor.
Because?
On two issues. One, the court ruled that there was no duty from the appellees here, the Browns, to Damon, the child who died in this case. And the second reason was that the attractive nuisance was not properly pled below.
In other words, it was procedurally defaulted.
Correct.
Why don't you address those issues frontally?
Yes, Your Honor. On the first issue, three cases that control the duty in this case that are Delaware court cases. Those cases are Porter versus Delmarva Power from this court in 1988, Fox versus Fox in 1999, and a Delaware district court case, Gorby versus Longwell, in, I believe, 2007. Those cases address the duties to a child, and those cases clearly state the common law duty to a child is to avoid simple negligence. That was first decided in the Porter case, where the child in that case was actually a trespasser, and in spite of the fact that the child was a trespasser, the duty still applied. And then, in the Fox case, this court extended that duty to invitees and licensees, children invitees and licensees. And also in the Gorby case talks about the rationale of the Delaware courts in deciding when a duty will exist.
Was the 7-year-old child invited to be there?
No, Your Honor. But the defendants, Bass, were aware that the child was brought there by the babysitter and allowed the child to stay. Instead of using...
So the Superior Court seemed to place a lot of emphasis on the fact that the babysitter was the person solely responsible, and that, you know, and the fact that they permitted them to stay didn't mean they didn't have other obligations with the party they were hosting, and that it was the babysitter's responsibility to take care of the child.
I understand. Yes, the court took that position.
All right, so tell us why, as a matter of law, the Superior Court decided this incorrectly.
As a matter of law, the Superior Court did not consider the 3 Delaware cases talking about the duties owed to a child, which is the duty of common negligence. And in this case, there happens to be more than one party responsible for the negligence. The homeowners, the party hosts, and the babysitter were all responsible.
Well, the trial court adopted as the law of the case the rule that there is no duty on the part of people positioned in the position of the Browns where the child is accompanied by a parent or other caregiver unless the parent or other caregiver relinquishes responsibility to, in this case, the Browns, the premises, or, you know, the party planners or whatever you want to call them, and unless that responsibility is assumed. That's the rule of law of the case. The court then went on to find that there was no evidence that there was any responsibility relinquished or assumed. Your brief doesn't frontally address that problem, at least as far as I can tell. Have I missed something?
I think our brief frontally addressed that in applying Delaware law to the facts of the case. The court's decision making the
You're saying that's not Delaware law? There doesn't have to be a relinquishment of responsibility and an acceptance of responsibility by someone other than the caregiver?
No, there does not, Your Honor.
All right.
The reasoning from the Superior Court ruling against my clients was based on out-of-state cases, a case from Maryland, a case from Alabama, and a case from Illinois that talk just about what Your Honor mentioned, the relinquishing of the duty, and they also talk in the terms of foreseeability of the parents and whether or not the foreseeability of the parents' negligence in not supervising the child. Those are the out-of-state cases that the Superior Court based the ruling on. The Superior Court completely ignored the cases that have a different view. The Delaware cases...
But did any of those Delaware cases deal with what you might call an intervening party who had some duty to the child?
I don't know that they directly dealt, any of those cases dealt with intervening party. The analysis of those cases rests on the stated law of this court back in Porter versus Delmarva in 1988, that the analysis and the reasoning is based on the acceptance that children of a tender age do not possess the same level of foreseeability or the same appreciation of danger.
We understand that, but a child is entitled to a certain deference because of their age, but there's still a question of who it is that owes that responsibility or that duty to the child. Is there any Delaware case that has made the distinction or held that the distinction is not appropriate to say where there is a parent or guardian who's responsible for the child, then others are not also responsible for the child?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor. They talk in terms of the relationship, and the duty comes from the analysis of the relationship between the actor and the duty to the child.
But so, there's got to be a person who has that duty,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
And are any of the Delaware cases you're relying on in any way similar in terms of there being one person who clearly was responsible for this child and other people who were at the same location who arguably were not responsible for the child?
Not that I can recall, Your Honor.
Whereas the cases from other jurisdictions that the court relied on were like this one, where it was a question of which of several parties had that duty, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So why aren't those cases the ones we should be looking to as opposed to Delaware cases that don't address the subject?
Because those cases do not analyze these cases the way the Delaware courts do, and Delaware law controls here. Porter and Fox are where the duties come from, regardless of the status of the license or the property owner, whether it's a premises guest claim, it doesn't matter. The issue is the relationship of the actor, in this case the Browns, to the child, in this case Damon Emery.
Right. Well, help us understand how the rule of law you're advocating would be applied. In this case, we have a babysitter, and we have the babysitter accompanied by an uninvited 7-year-old. Let's put that aside. Let's assume hypothetically a 7-year-old comes to someone else's house with their parent. And what's the rule of law that imposes a duty on the homeowner once the child arrives with their parent? As I understand your argument, once the parent arrives with the 7-year-old, the homeowner has a duty to the 7-year-old child that's commensurate with the parents.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the duty from the actor to the child is the duty, common law duty, to avoid simple negligence. In the case that you describe, and it depends on the risk and balancing whether the risk, even if it's a homeowner, and the action that they could take is minor in compared to the risk to the child, that's what controls.
Well, the problem is you're formulating the duty as one of avoiding simple negligence. But that begs the question of whether there was simple negligence here, where there was no necessarily any duty to foresee the caregiver, whether it be a parent or a babysitter, would not be performing his or her job.
In this case, there is, Your Honor. At one point during this children's party, the Browns called everyone to the deck for singing of happy birthday and eating birthday cake. And the deck was away from the pool in an enclosed porch. At that point, it could be construed that the Browns relinquished everyone else, all of the parents that they called away to sing happy birthday and have cake, of their responsibilities of looking after or preventing someone from going into this pool. It would have been very simple in this case for the Browns to designate one person to watch that pool to make sure that a 7-year-old who couldn't swim wouldn't enter that pool when everyone had been called to the deck.
The Browns would be negligent in those circumstances because they relied on someone else as carrying out their responsibility to assure that the children were safely out of the pool?
Whether the Browns breached that duty is a question for the jury.
Well, if the Browns were in one room of their house, this is a hypothetical, and the parent took the 7-year-old child into another room, and then the parent left the room so the 7-year-old was not supervised, and the 7-year-old pulled a bookcase down on themselves or did something like that, what would be the Browns' responsibility?
I don't believe that's the same kind of a situation, Your Honor.
I know. That's why we call them hypotheticals.
Yes. Their duty is different in that case. Number one, because in this case involved an attractive nuisance, the pool, which is an artificial condition on the land.
Well, I'm just trying to develop your rule of law. I'm trying to start with a simple example and then build up to the rule of law you want us to apply. Because in every case we hear, we need to not only decide your case, we have to understand its implication for other cases. So I'm starting with the 7-year-old left in a room with a bookcase, and we can move to the 7-year-old left alone at the pool. But first tell me, what is the homeowner's responsibility with regard to a child left unattended by their parent in a room with a bookcase that they pull down on top of themselves?
the homeowner's duty is to make the home as reasonably safe for others as they would for their own family. And I believe in that case that Your Honor described, a jury could find that the homeowner accomplished that duty, that the bookcase was not an attractive nuisance, not an artificial condition, and there was no direct duty. A jury could find that.
All right, so then this goes back to whether the artificial nuisance issue was in your complaint, doesn't it?
Correct, Your Honor.
Because at least the complaint that the Superior Court was deciding didn't involve the artificial nuisance, and you wanted to get that issue to the court, and they declined to do that. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, I take the position that in the complaints, attractive nuisance was pled, and it was pled by reference in the second amended complaint, I believe in paragraphs 14 and...
All right, so let's assume that's true in the interest of time. What you're saying is that the presence of a parent or guardian with a 7-year-old doesn't change the application of the law if there's an attractive nuisance. So in other words, it's one thing to have a 7-year-old wandering around by themselves with an attractive nuisance, but it's an entirely different situation for the 7-year-old to be walking around with their parent, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if the 7-year-old is attracted to the nuisance when they're in their parents' care, why is the homeowner liable?
Because the degree of foreseeability of a child being attracted to that nuisance is so great that a reasonable measure taken by the homeowner would prevent the child from getting there, especially as in the facts of this case, when the parents were pulled away for some other purpose. The degree that the homeowner has to take some affirmative action is much less than the risk to the child being attracted by the attracted nuisance.
Are you saying that there's a different duty owed by the homeowner when there's an attractive nuisance, even if the child is accompanied by his parent?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that duty is what?
That is the duty to avoid simple negligence. And simple negligence in this case is being a child of tender years who couldn't swim being attracted to the pool. And the duty to avoid simple negligence.
You're into the time you wanted to reserve. Would you like to retain that?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May it please the Court. My name is Arthur Kuhl. I represent the defendants below, the appellees, Tracy and Tierra Brown. This is sort of a convoluted case, but I think it can be broken down quite simply in the way it should be, in that you look at the complaint that was finally filed, the second amended complaint. We look at the allegations, and they are defended and investigated. Discovery is conducted. The claims that were finally made against the Browns were that they either attended or hosted a party, and they were negligent in doing so because there was a pool and there was the potential that there was children attending that did not know how to swim. If that is a negligent allegation, as a condition precedent, I would say there has to be an assumption, although it's not clearly stated, that then there would therefore be a duty to not attend or host a party that had a pool and the potential children that didn't know how to swim. And I think
Can I interrupt you because I'm having trouble following what you're saying, first of all, but second of all, I'm more concerned about something else. Is it your position that if the trial court had allowed the case to proceed on an attractive nuisance theory, that this would have to have gone to the jury?
I'm not sure because it wasn't worked up. Attractive nuisance, and that would have been a whole other set of briefings. Attractive nuisance typically involves a trespasser being attracted to an actual object. In this particular case, and I think it's akin to the lawnmower case, it was an activity at the Urquhart's home, the pool, and the party at the pool that brought the child there, and he wasn't attracted. He was brought by either the caregiver,
a parent. So is your position that there is no attractive nuisance claim, so it really doesn't matter whether it was in or out of the case?
It's my position it should not have been in the case to begin with. If it was in the case, I think it would have been dismissed because this is not just simply not an attractive nuisance case. It is a party. They were not attracted to a particular pool or
equipment. So are you saying, I just want to talk in terms of theory as opposed to, you know, what happened here. Are you saying that there can be no claim based upon an attractive nuisance if you are an invitee as opposed to a trespasser?
I think it's much more difficult. Now, if you're invited into the house and say it's December and it's a Christmas party and someone and the child is somehow not watched and then gets out of the house and goes over to the pool, that's a different situation as opposed to being invited to the house for the pool. And I think in those type of situations where you're invited either directly or through a surrogate.
Well, let's assume the person is invited. Let's get over the business about whether the person was invited or not. You're saying that because this was a pool party, there's no attractive nuisance claim.
I'm saying because this was a pool party and that the child was brought to it by a responsible person, there cannot be an attractive nuisance claim under those facts.
So the same fact, which ended up defeating the simple negligence claim, namely that there was a caregiver or someone responsible for supervising the child, would also defeat an attractive nuisance claim, assuming that attractive nuisance were properly in the case.
Correct. Under the typical attractive nuisance claim, the Newark Country Club one, there is a child alone or at least not supervised by adults. I think once you have someone bringing the child to the event or to the object, to the whatever the supposed attractive nuisance would be, then I don't think it should be an attractive nuisance. You don't take your child for, you know, a walk through, you know, the park or something, and then there's a fall and go, oh, nobody warned us about, you know, the bridge or the water or the rock or whatever it was that caused an injury. You're bringing someone to a pool party.
Okay, well, as I understand what happened here, the trial court decided that attractive nuisance had not been pled initially, and then wouldn't allow that claim to be added because the trial court was under the impression that there would have to be discovery?
Correct.
What discovery that hadn't already been taken in connection with the overall circumstances would apply to attractive nuisance?
Well, in order to get to the attractive nuisance against the Browns to begin with, there hadn't been discovery over whether or not the Browns had any sort of possession over this particular Urquhart property.
And that hadn't been taken?
No, that hadn't been taken. It was, frankly, assumed they were guests of the Urquharts, and the Urquharts were allowing them to use their property for the two-year-old's birthday. They had been friends for years.
And I thought that those were the established facts. Was there something else?
Well, that's not enough to decide whether or not there was some sort of possession. I think the last time I was here with the Target case about, you know, there's a lot of discovery over who has control.
But this is summary judgment, and wouldn't there be an inference that the Browns, who were not the owners but were allowed for the evening to use the house to give this party, had the necessary possession of the pool, as well as the kitchen and the living room?
Not under the facts that were undergone during the discovery. I mean, there was no
inference could be drawn.
I don't think you can draw an inference in the absence of any facts. I think you can draw inferences once you have the facts, if there's an inference to be drawn.
Well, but
from
it
the
was
facts.
Undisputed, was it not, that the Browns were given permission to use those premises for one evening to put on this party?
Correct.
And doesn't it follow, since the children were, you know, using the pool and came in later into the kitchen or the living room to eat ice cream and cake, that the Browns, who were putting on this party with the permission of the owners, had whatever possession of those rooms and facilities as was required?
Well, that would, like I said, would have required some additional discovery. Did they have exclusive possession? The Urquharts were still there. I think it would not be a correct inference to assume that the Browns could have done whatever they wanted to do during these certain number of hours that they were at the Urquharts' residence. Certainly,
well,
they wouldn't have had...
That may make the Urquharts jointly and severally liable with the Browns, but it wouldn't change the liability, if any, of the Browns, would it?
It would establish some sort of parameters to at least start an analysis as to whether or not they were the possessors of the property. And then
even in an attractive nuisance case, isn't what distinguishes the present case is the presence of the babysitter? Because if you look at the attractive nuisance cases that have been decided by this court and other courts, you normally have a child attracted to the nuisance. But this is a situation where if there's a nuisance that could be attractive, the parent is there to say, no, don't go near the pool. Or the parent says, don't climb in the culvert. Or whatever else a child might think would be fun to do that the homeowner would otherwise have to prevent. Here, the prevention is the responsibility of the parent.
And that would be the second part of the whole analysis. You don't get to the first part until you have a homeowner or a possessor, and then you get to the attractive nuisance part. And my argument is it even if this was properly pled, it would lose on the first instance because I think it's clear they're not possessors of the property. I think the Urquharts would have been surprised to determine that they were turning over complete possession of their property gratis for 4 hours as opposed to having guests.
I understand your argument with the first part. My question really goes to the second part. If you have someone completely in control possession of an attractive nuisance, doesn't the presence of the babysitter change the equation? Because whatever responsibility you might have otherwise had, it seems it changes dramatically once you have the responsible adult who's with the child.
I think that's correct, because when you go back to what's the duties to avoid the attractive nuisance liability is to make it reasonably safe. And I would frankly argue you cannot possibly make something more reasonably safe than having the child directly supervised by their parent or the parent's designee or babysitter. You cannot do anything else other than having someone directly responsible, and that is a parental duty, and I'm not sure I understand where the argument comes from that basic parental duty of watching your own child, regardless of how that actually comes about, is somehow can be superseded, overtaken, removed, or modified.
So to boil it all down, is it your position that the trial court could have ruled that, yes, I will consider the claim of attractive nuisance, and I am granting summary judgment for your client because there's no viable claim for attractive nuisance?
I think there was enough evidence for them to deny it, and I'm not sure there was enough evidence that the court was comfortable in doing the complete analysis based on what was there.
I'm lost then, because what you're saying is that as long as there was a guardian or parent supervising the child, then it doesn't matter whether there was an attractive nuisance because there was somebody there to prevent an injury.
Yes. But
and that being the case, that's the end of the case, right?
Well, that's the end of that particular part of the claim. I mean, their actual complaint was pleading failure to supervise and failure to warn and negligent in having the party. The attractive nuisance, frankly, was a surprise when it was brought up during the arguments, and it was never actually briefed.
All right. You are of the position that the trial court correctly granted you summary judgment.
Yeah, it's our position.
And all I'm asking you is it also your position that the trial court could have equally granted you summary judgment on an attractive nuisance claim.
Yes, I am convinced if it was actually briefed and argued that the court would have also said this is not an attractive nuisance case, even if it was, there is no breach of the attractive nuisance duties, or they've met those duties by the very nature that there was someone there who agreed. Bass agreed, yeah, I brought them, I'm watching the ones that I brought, and they're watching the ones that they brought. The Browns both agreed to that, and I don't think anyone cited to a single piece of the record of any person at the pool that thought otherwise, that, no, well, we were wondering who was going to be watching the kids. Just none of that testimony whatsoever. Everyone just assumes, and it's a standard parental, I guess, assumption. I don't want to cite, you know, grandmother's second desk reference, but parents watch their own children.
Well, you started the argument by saying it's simple. This case is simple and straightforward. So let me try to keep it simple and straightforward with this question. As I understand your position, based on the complaint that everyone, the amended complaint, the Superior Court correctly granted summary judgment in your favor. Second issue is, should the Superior Court have permitted an amendment to the complaint to specifically add attractive nuisance? Your response to that is twofold. The Superior Court properly said, no, you can't amend the complaint. But to the extent that ruling was erroneous and the complaint should have been amended, the denial was harmless because even if attractive nuisance had been alleged, based on the facts that had been developed during the prior discovery, there would have been no attractive nuisance claim.
Correct. Okay. However you end up, you get to the same, you know, the same result. I was a little hesitant in putting it that directly just because it wasn't briefed below.
No, I understand, but tell me now why the Superior Court, putting aside the harmless error, why did the Superior Court correctly say you can't amend your complaint again?
Well, number one, there wasn't an actual motion to amend. It was simply, well, it doesn't look like the court thinks that this was properly pled, so we're going to file a new cause of action, this typical splitting of the cause of action to try and then try to consolidate it to do it that way. So there wasn't.
Let me interrupt you there with regard to splitting the cause of action. So where do you understand things are now? The Superior Court has made this subsequent ruling that was brought to our attention about splitting causes of action, and the Superior Court said, let's wait until this appeal is over, and then we'll see what I'm going to do. So what do you understand the status of the pending matter in the Superior Court to be?
The pending matter is stayed pending this decision. The reasons the court stated was if the court decides that the it was properly pled in that second amended complaint, then this third complaint or fourth complaint is now moot because all those issues were actually there. If it's sent back for another reason, then that may alleviate any other issues that came up with it being brought up. If it's affirmed, then it's a clear splitting of the cause of action and res judicata or collateral estoppel apply.
So if we look at just where we are now, as you said, there was no formal motion to amend the complaint.
I'm not aware of it.
But subsequent to the filing of this appeal or during the pendency of this appeal, there was a formal motion to amend the complaint.
No, there was there was a motion to consolidate.
Well, there was a new lawsuit filed.
It was a brand new lawsuit filed.
And a motion to consolidate.
Right, new case number.
Right. And the court refused to consolidate because the court held
trial.
It would be an end run around the discovery deadline.
Discovery deadline and all
okay,
the other
so,
deadlines.
So, but the court didn't dismiss the second suit. It just let it lie there, and now it's been stayed.
Right. The court decided to let that last fourth lawsuit just stand as its own. It wasn't going to be consolidated into this one. It was 3 months before trial. Full briefing had been done, and they weren't going to disturb the president.
And what's the theory of the new lawsuit?
To bring the attractive nuisance and the arguments that there were possessors, that the Browns were possessors. And I just want to make the quick point on the Browns. You know, there's the mother and then there's the grandmother. And the allegations against the grandmother were for negligent attendance of a party. And I have a couple of comments, is that if the plaintiff's arguments are accepted, this would have, I think, a chilling effect on minor child social interaction. Why would anybody have a party with anyone if they are deemed negligent, if someone shows up that wasn't invited, not anticipated, and is somehow hurt? And I don't think the rulings would be so limited as to only apply to a pool situation. It certainly is would be probably applicable, as well, most county and state parks have pavilions where they have birthday parties and such. You know, it's as likely somebody could get hurt falling off a little rock wall or a slide or a swing, and then you have almost the same situation. You have people having a party at another location with the parents, and someone gets hurt. I think that would have a chilling effect on parental responsibility and transfer of parental responsibility over the parents' wishes. Parents can decide whether to attend a party. I don't think it should be a rule that you cannot invite friends or neighbors because they happen to have smaller children who don't know how to swim. Parents can decide whether to attend, not attend. Invitation to a party is not a command if it's not appropriate for that particular child, and the parents cannot do it. I think what the plaintiffs are actually arguing is that there is a duty to avoid the malfeasance, and but that's not the case. Certainly, if you're throwing a party for young children, it's certainly negligent to hand out fireworks. Here, go play with these bottle rockets. What they're arguing is that there's this misfeasance, which is actually now malfeasance, because there's things that they should have done that they normally would have no reason to think to do. There was arguments in there that the party hosts should not have assumed that the parents would have watched their children 100% of the time. And I guess that assumes that you would be watching other people's children to the exclusion of your own. I think the best rule is...
Well, you're arguing, in effect, that there's no duty because the parent or other caregiver on the scene is entitled to assume... the landowner or the landowner's surrogates are entitled to assume that the caregiver will supervise the child properly, and that assumption holds unless there is an explicit transfer of responsibility to the landowner or homeowner and an acceptance of that responsibility.
My time's up, but yes, you shouldn't be watching other people's children unless you agree to do it, and the parents agree you're the proper person to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Your Honor. To go back to a question I believe Justice Holland asked, I didn't get to another duty that we raised in our arguments. The second question was whether or not the Browns assumed a duty, and we relied on Delaware law again in the Furet case for the general principle that once someone assumes a duty, then you have a duty to carry out that duty, execute that duty. We take the position, based on all the facts in the record, that the Browns assumed the duty by hosting the party, planning the party, inviting guests, controlling the activities, decorating, calling people out of the pool, that they assumed a duty. And they had a duty under the Furet case to...
You're saying they should be deemed to have assumed a duty, whether or not they actually agreed to do it?
Correct, Your Honor. The Gorby case, which is a Delaware...
Don't you agree that no matter... And that the presence of the babysitter or the parent, if they objected to what the Browns wanted to do, the Browns couldn't have said, no, we're going to do that anyway. That the babysitter or the parent would have the final say over what the 7-year-old did or did not do?
Yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would concede that. But I don't believe that's the facts as fleshed out in the deposition process of what happened in this case. Secondly, in essence, the Superior Court below could have told us on the attractive nuisance issue under Rule 9B to either more particularly plead the original complaint or even in the second complaint that was timely filed before the statute. We could have more particularly pled the nuisance if that bothered the court, or the court could have ruled that the facts conform the pleadings to the evidence, which the court can do at any time, including up through trial. In essence, what the court did in this case was dismiss the complaint, which, if nothing else, is basically a sanction against the parents for inartful pleading or not pleading correctly or not raising attractive nuisance correctly. This court, post-briefing in the Wilson case, issued the decision of Draca versus Hitchens, where a similar case, not exactly the issue, but an expert was excluded in that case prior to any sanctions being filed against counsel. In this case, there were many opportunities for the court to either sanction us, ask us to replead, or to grant the amending of the evidence. There was no prejudice in this case to the Browns.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and we'll take a brief recess.